Thank you, Brother Henry, for that opening prayer, and Sister Julie for the organ playing. Well, it's the afternoon session, and we look forward to picking back up where we left off. We appreciated the discourses this morning of Brother Mark and Brother Todd, and we hope you had good fellowship during the luncheon time together. We look forward to Brother Ray Luke's discourse this afternoon, and he has decided to bring to us the importance of God, our Creator. So we look forward to those comments, and as the theme prayer by Brother Henry was, we ask it to be a blessing to the Lord. So Brother Ray, please continue.
Thank you, Brother Jonathan. And it's a joy to be with you, dear brethren. It's always a privilege to fellowship with the Lord's dear people. And to bring to you the loving greetings of your brethren at Jersey City. They are few in numbers, but warm in spirit and in love for one another. And then, too, I've been asked to convey the love of Brother Cornelius and Stanley Fields from the Bulgodai Poland Ecclesia. They called and wanted to have their love sent to you all. And then also the Orlando, Florida Bible students, where we were privileged to be, also want to be remembered. Just want you to know that our fellowship is worldwide, and the love for you is as fervent all over the world, because we are all one in Christ. As has been suggested, we'll just carry on in the same vein that you had been hearing of this morning. I think we've all been uplifted and blessed by the spirit and by the urgency and the depth and profound interest and love and concern for our positions as Bible students. You know, we are in a society in the world where our values, our beliefs are much under siege, where all of the adversary's tools and machinations, where the world and our flesh have been so mobilized together as to undermine the purpose for which we are called. And I join with the Brother Grillo and with the previous discussion on the need for our vigilance. And there's perhaps no more greater inroads or siege of our beliefs than in the realm of the intellect, and how the adversary has poisoned the young minds, and how the environment just seems to be permeated with skepticism and with doubt and with self-sufficiency and with the pursuit of one's own hedonistic examples and hedonistic desires. And there's no more greater area in which this is done than the attempts to rule God out of the universe. And this has really been the whole intent, that if God is dead, there's no need for the values and for the principles that are enunciated in God's word. So accordingly, the whole environment is just seems to be permeated with intellectual substituting an idol of man in lieu of worship of God. And I suppose there is no greater evidence of that than in the movements that we see in Christianity today. We see the New Age movement, for example, in which they are now beginning to make the inroads of heathenism, the inroads of other Oriental beliefs, mysticism, and trying to establish a universal principle so that all beliefs and thought systems are the same. And then they all incorporate in one great tolerance in which all mankind can agree upon. Well, I suppose there's no greater expression of that sentiment than what they call neo-pantheism. Pantheism is where they believe that God is one with nature and therefore subject to change. He becomes God in man and the world, and all things are God and have his substance. The New Meridian Webster Dictionary defines pantheism as a doctrine that equates God with the laws and forces of the universe. Universe is God, and conversely, that there is no God apart from substance, focus, and laws manifested in the universe. God is not an entity outside of nature, but is nature itself. It is a basis for atheism, and therefore the living, active moral order of the world is itself God, and we need no other God. So pantheism is characterized by many Buddhist and Hindu doctrines as well. The Hebrew Dutch rationalist and philosopher Benedictus Spinoza, who is the idol of this belief and concept, formulated the most thoroughly pantheistic philosophy and his system, arguing that God and nature are merely two names for one reality. And so, with this kind of unity, there is just this desire to just legislate God out of existence. And you know, scoffers will come, as we've heard earlier this morning, and that there is this weapon of undermining faith and beliefs, particularly amongst the young people. And if you just get the minds of the oncoming generation and just able to capture it, how the adversary will keep it enslaved into his own thought systems. And in contradiction to that, dear brethren, we who stand for the truth as manifested in God's word, look to that as the source of our comfort and the basis, bedrock of our faith. And as we then consider the scriptures, I suppose there's few more exemplary illustrations that we can point to than David himself, the sweet singer of Israel, how he confirmed and how he establishes the nature of God as creator, and how as creator he is all pervasive. Not that God is nature, but God is the creator of nature. God is the wisdom, the power, and the first cause that puts into place the fundamental laws that govern the universe, which mankind looks back and says, well, that is nature. But because they see the wisdom and the orderliness of it and believe by spontaneous regeneration, that is, it can come about by itself. There's no need for a first cause. There is, therefore, a desire to say that these principles are merely abstractions and that they of themselves can account for all of the phenomena and all of the wonders that we see in our whole world system. But, of course, there's a great difference between the creation and the creator. Science doesn't want to look at the creator because that would require a first cause. That would require a beginning. But, you know, they simply cannot explore that aspect. They only can see what they can measure, what they can formulate and put into human terms as the basis of their sciences. But we see that in God's wisdom, God put into his human creation those principles in accordance with his own character and in his own intelligent design. a plan which you and I know as the divine plan of the ages. Oh, the adversary will not allow. The agitator will deceive and send strong delusions so as to becloud the minds of all that do not accept and believe by faith. And so I would want to look at some of the words that I believe of David, which are so compelling and which are so insightful, which can really define not only the creation of the physical universe, but the highest form of the physical and material existence that is man himself. Right? David can see man as the highlight, as the essence, as the high point of God's creation in the human and material realm. And in so looking, we look in the 19th Psalm. How beautifully David is able to appreciate, explore, and then to analyze and to equate what that view of God means in his life. He says the heavens declare in the 19th Psalm the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork. He knew from his study of the Torah, he knew that Genesis 1:1 gives more cosmology in that one 10-word text than all of the printed books and all of the billions upon billions of dollars of research and all of the great minds of the world. How in those 10 little words, it all comes together. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Time, in the beginning, created. He is the creator. Behind any creation, there has to be a design. There has to be an actor. There has to be one in intelligence to bring it all about. He created the heavens. Oh, yes. There was a void. There was nothing in the heavens throughout all eternity. But now there was a heavens. And there could not be a heavens without there also being an earth. The heavens and the earth. Because what is the distinction between a void, nothing at all, and space? Why? Simply one introduction of a particle would make that void now a space, because there can be then a measurement made which accounts for space. So in the beginning there was time, there was space, and there was matter. He created the earth. And so there David synthesizes in one succinct statement all the wisdom of all of our materialistic teachers throughout all of history. And so he says, the glory of God, the firmness showeth his handiwork. Day under day uttereth speech, and night under night showeth knowledge. There is no speech nor language, there is no voice is not heard. Their line is gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. I wish we could expound on these in detail. I would love to be able to just pull apart the various descriptions here that David uses, but time, I know, cannot allow. But suffice it to say that the physical heavens at night and during the day, they just proclaim the power and the glory, the majesty, and the wisdom of a force, intelligence, which cannot be denied. You know, there's been so much of this in history. You know, simply by making statements, and rational statements perhaps, but then using them as rationalizations or in a deceptive manner can really poison the whole conclusion. And here we see that the desire to just account for all of the beautiful, and when we think of the myriads of creation. Oh, I wish we could go into the night, to the universe and all the billions and billions of other universes that they believe might still be out there. And the more they probe through their space telescopes and the Hubble improvement, the more they are just pushing back the horizons of creation. And they are able to even determine the what they believe is to be the areas in which this Big Bang, which is the fact of creation, must have come from. And thus we see that the physical heavens declares a glory. And the story is told that when Napoleon was going to invade Egypt, and they were on the vessel with his general staff, and just discussing amongst themselves the prevailing philosophies of the rationalists. And it was about that time when the French rationalists from the Reformation and from the Renaissance were picking up the ancient concepts and beliefs, and under some of their philosophical believers, such as Voltaire and Rousseau and so forth, they were concluding, oh, there's no personal God. And therefore, Napoleon just said, well, gentlemen, you are making all sorts of statements, but why do you do with this? And he points to the heavens. How do you account for that? And the conclusion was that the generals could not respond at all. They were speechless. There is no gainsaying the testimony of the universe. And the more we know of the universe, the more we realize the grandeur and the impossibility of man to account for it. But then David goes, using the telescope, looks from the macro. He looks from the infinite. He looks from the greatness, from everlasting. And he then begins to term not only the vision of the universes, but rather now brings it closer to home. And he brings it now into our solar system. He sees that in our solar system itself, that there is an activity, that there is a program that shows forth the manifest wisdom of a divine power. And he says, and then has he set a tabernacle, that is in the firmament. He set a tent for the sun, which is as a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, rejoicing as a strong man to run a race, going forth from the end of the heavens and his circuit under the end of it. And there is nothing hid from the heat thereof. There he describes. Day unto day shows speech. There he sees in that morning dawn the rising of the sun and its heavenly procession crossed to the zenith of the heavens and then the sunset in the west. And he sees them as a triumphant, as though it were a triumphant bridegroom, going out now to meet his beloved, and then rejoicing as though he were a strong man running in a race, to the race, to the end, to the zenith, and then ultimately to the horizon. And there he's going forth from the end of the heavens and his circuit unto the ends of it. There's nothing hidden from the heat of it. Nothing is hidden from the heat of it. It is a source of life. Without the sun, there could be no life. There could be no heat. There could be no light. And thus, how beautiful the testimony day after day, upon with perfect precision, with clockwork that can be anticipated henceforth for any number of years, as it has in the back, because it is according to universal principles and laws that are inviolable. And thus we see how just as God had created this glorious fixed system of balances, where the laws of equilibrium are able to balance each other, and the sun can be relied upon to make its majestic journey through the heavens, 365.25 days a year. And so, as we see that God had created for his physical needs of man, but we notice the imagery that is used here by David is the sun rising in the east, and how that imagery is used throughout God's scriptures as revealed to his holy prophets. Oh, the sun of righteousness shall rise with healing in its beams. Oh, in symbolic terms. And then it is running a course as a bridegroom through the heavens, and a bridegroom seeking a bride. A bridegroom looking forward to the consummation of their relationship with the bride. And then it says, and rejoices at the strong man to run a race. Oh, just as that sun is rejoicing and running towards the west, so the bridegroom is seeking his bride and rejoicing, and as a strong man to run a race. And oh, I'm thinking of Isaiah 53, in which he shall divide the strong he shall divide the spoils with the strong, and how God is symbolically riding in through this physical creation of the solar system, how he is also symbolically telling us that he has an even grander, a more glorious plan in view, of which the solar system is merely an example. And he said, to run a race, and to run a race, and how that is so prominent in God's imagery, and how we are told that we are to run this race for the high calling. And then going forth from the ends of the earth, and there is nothing hid from the heat thereof. And when that race is run, and when that course is done, nothing shall be hid from the blessings of that course. And when the millennial blessings, the heat, the warmth, the life-giving power from that universe will then be reflected, and nothing shall be hid from it. All of creation and all who have died in Adam will come forth and bask in the glories of that sunshine. But then David goes from the physical universe to our here and now present solar system. But then he tells us how this all comes about. And it's interesting that the first four chapters, he deals with the universe. The next three chapters, he deals now with the laws of God. And in them, he tells us from verse 7 through 10. He says, the law, if I just read it here, God's glory and goodness. I'm just going to paraphrase it. God's glory and goodness appears much in the works of his creation, but much more in and by divine revelation. Scripture reveals our duty to God, and of our expectation from God, and of much greater use and benefit to us than day and night. We see that now David looks more as to the internal. He's looking for now not to the physical, but rather now he is seeking how the laws that operate the physical operate. And he looks not only at the creation, but now he's looking at the Creator. And as the Creator reveals himself, David, in the next two or three verses, six times enumerates who that Creator is. And he uses the word Jehovah, the Lord. And he speaks about how that revelation now comes to us and how we react to it. He says, and The law of the Lord is perfect. It's free of all human corruption. It is perfectly filling with all our good. And 2 Timothy 3:17 tells us further, nothing is to be added to it, nor taken from it. It is to correct the souls, to bring back to God and to our own obligation to Him. As he says, the law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. And then secondly, the testimony of the Lord is sure, a sure foundation of lasting hope. It will make the simple wise if they be of humble heart and mind. Psalms 35:9 tells us that. And we have so many examples in Scripture of the testimony of their lives, of those who have so submitted in their humble way to be the wisdom and to the precepts of God. And thus he says, the testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. Oh, thank God that we were simple and humble and of no reputation, that we are able then to accept that perfect law. And then thirdly, the statutes of the law are right. They're exactly expressing with the principles and rules of God. Because they are right, they shall rejoice the heart, comfort, and it lays the foundation for a lasting joy and freedom. How the laws of God, the statutes of God, are all righteous. And as we live by them, we are so rejoicing, so liberating. We can experience the fullness of God's character. And as we seek to emulate that, how it so invites our heart. Oh, during intermission, I have just had the privilege to speak to one of you who has just recently learned of the beauties of the truth and how I could just see reflected in her life and in her whole full expression the joy of release from the bondages of the illusion and of doctrinal fears which are so impregnated by false teachings, and the liberating happiness that I could see in Sister's face just made me feel a sense of sharing and a sense of likewise experience somewhat the joy that she had. And so, number four, we see that the commandments of the Lord is pure. It is the ordinary means which the Spirit uses to instruct the unto in righteousness. It enlightens the eyes. It's right and wrong, and the Ten Commandments reveal sin and direction in the way of duty, as we see as Paul writing in Romans, as we read, the statutes of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandments of the Lord are pure, enlightening the eyes. We see the commandments of the Lord are pure. There is perfection in them. And as we then see the commandments of God, we recognize in ourselves how far short we come of those commandments and how the perfection of God requires that we, to be like-minded, need to be cleansed. We need to be healed. We need to be helped to live up to the principles, not in our flesh, but rather in our hearts. And then the last, the fear of the Lord will clean the way, Psalms 124:9, and it endures forever. And reverence, without which we can not be pleasing to God, and we will forever be required. Will forever be required. The statutes of the Lord are right. Commandments of the Lord are pure, enlightening the eyes, and the fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. As we see then the purity of the law and how it cleanses us as we endeavor to carry it out by our faith in the cleansing means that God has given to us, namely the righteousness of Christ, how he can be imputed to us. And if we follow that law and follow that commandment, we will then by faith accept God's terms of our righteousness and purity, and how it enlightens the eyes, how we are able to recognize that their salvation cannot be through works, but rather through our faith. And the fear of the Lord, the reverence for him is clean. I appreciated the remarks made earlier this morning that we should give those 180 seconds to just, before we approach God in prayer, just give a sense of pause where we can think of the majesty and the awe and the greatness and the privilege that we have of being able to petition the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, the creator of all the universe. Well, he will just now bow down and listen to our faintest cry and our most earnest plea. Oh, if we could only just have that sense of greatness and vastness and privilege that we have, how our prayers would be so much more effective, and how we would realize the privileges and the honor that is bestowed upon us to have that opportunity. Thus we see that this is the purpose, the law, in which we can now see the Creator. And we see him in all the splendor and beauty and majesty of which he is worthy. But you know, and I'm sorry I must just hasten on like this, but the beauty of David, and he was so modern, he was so wise, he was so insightful. The beauty of David is that he now was able to see the influence of this divine creator. He was not able to see him only in the physical, but he went beyond the infinite into the infinitesimal. He now, as it were, uses this great gigantic, he had used this great gigantic telescope to look into the past and to see the physical universe. Now he is bringing before our attention a divine microscope, in which now he is now turning his attention to the infinitesimal. And he's now turning our attention in this psalm, not just merely the molecules and atoms, but he's going beyond that. He's going into what results from the physical creation. And I think it was kind of touched upon this morning. I believe it was Brother Grillo. He said he was speaking about motivation. He was speaking about how people can be used and how they can be helped to do, not merely, and to want to do, and to have the emotions and the feelings, and to be able to come and use their physical authority and power in a way that we call thought, in a way we call consciousness. We cannot equate it. What is thought? What is consciousness? There can be no human explanation for it. It's merely that we know that we are composed of matter and atoms and molecules, but they of themselves cannot give volition, cannot give choice. There is the secret of life in which all of the physical components are merely reflecting a force of power that is abstract. This is beyond even the material. And thus we see man standing in the midpoint between the infinite and the infinitesimal. Now here is where David comes with such modern concept. And it was touched upon this morning by both speakers, how man is so mightily put, it's so mightily composed. And he says, he sees the law, the commandments that God has given. He sees these requirements, but he looks then within himself. And then he just changes the focus. He looks in the inner heart. He uses that microscope of divine wisdom. And he says then, who can understand his errors? Suddenly he stops. He sees what God's character is like, and then he introspects and says, who can understand his errors? I see now that I'm sinful. I see that I cannot measure up. And therefore, he asks these questions. Keep back thy servant from presumptuous sins. Let them not have dominion over me, and I shall be innocent of the great transgression. Oh, what insight. What now, how he begins to understand what's wrong with me. Why can I measure up or not measure up to what I know is to be the principles governing the universe, and I am just a part of it. And thus we see that he's looking now into the very concepts of, so up to date, the concepts of consciousness, the concept of conscious and the unconscious. Oh, mankind seems to be startled by there is such a thing as unconscious. And what are the principles of behavior? Why do we react the way we do? Why do we say the things we are regretting later on? Why is it that somehow we can't always get things right? I act and then I think thereafter. I use rational means to get a rationalization. And as has been said by Brother Grillo earlier today, we sometimes use, you know, the intellectual to get what the flesh is seeking. And we can put, you know, we can justify, we can make any kinds of excuses if we just long enough think. And it depends on what our objectives and what our real feelings are like. We know, and David realized, that in our memory, there is a consciousness and there is principles and forces within us that are unconscious, unknown to us. That's why he asks, who can know his sins? Who can know his errors? You know, all unresolved problems and all of the inheritance and the DNA of the past, all of the experiences that we go through, what happens to us, all have an impact. They are all within ourselves and they are buried in our subconscious. As a matter of fact, it is said that it is like the tip of the iceberg. Only 10% or even less of our consciousness is known, is conscious, and all the rest, the 90-plus percentage, is still unconscious. But there is a part of life that we don't know about. And from time to time, these impulses, these feelings, these memories, these unresolved problems are breaking through to our consciousness. And we wonder why we did or said or thought as we have. And then we say, oh, this is, I don't mean these things. It just happens to be that way. It just means I get impulsive, or I say, or I regret what I have said. And then we see that these forces are in operation. And you know, the adversary plays on that so much. Oh, yes, you are not. Who do you think you can be in the image of Christ? You aspire to be lifting up the righteousness of Christ, the laws of Christ that you are enjoined to live by. Oh, how the adversary discourages. Oh, how he would just make us want to drop and stop and realize that this is too much for me. But we see, dear friends, that when these experiences happen, we know that we have tried. Our intent was right, but they couldn't. It was a breakthrough, perhaps, of some of those things of the past. We cannot explain, we cannot account for them. They're not known to us, but God tries to reveal them to us. We don't know them because they are so much a part of our past, and they are forgotten. They are too painful to remember and therefore submerged. But yet they are acting and they are having their experiences in all that we say, do, and think. How we need, dear brethren, to then realize that God, in aspiring to make us in the image of Christ, or help us to become in the image of Christ, he then, through his providences, through his guidance and through his direction, he makes our circumstances such where he can try to bring out to us some of these deficiencies, some of these errors, some of these weaknesses with which we are inborn. And how does he do that? He sends us experiences. He sends us a little sample. Oh, I wish we could use the medical model for this. But he kind of brings to our experiences some of samples of what we are deficient in, like vaccinations. He gives us, as it were, a little vaccination experience so that we can build up the resistance and the immunity against a more serious invasion of the adversary. And that is why, dear friends, if I am somewhat weak along the lines of selfishness, he will give me experiences that will reveal that to me. He will give me those necessary opportunities to learn from those experiences. And that is why each and every one of us goes through life in a very different, unique, characterized way. We are given such a broad range of experiences because lurking underneath in our whole character structure and our past Adamic existence and our present Adamic existence are these unknown lessons, are these unknown defects which need to be revealed so that we can work on them. And so as he reveals to you in your unique lifestyle and in your unique daily experiences, we are so different. And although we are pursuing the same goals with the same means and resources, we do it in different ways because God is tailor-making each day of your life and each experience of that day for your learning, so that you might know what are the things that we are deficient in and that you can work on them. Oh, I wish we could develop that theme, but I see our time is up. And so, dear friends, we have our great Creator, and how wonderful, how blessed we are. Let us allow his creative power to have full expression in our lives. You know, we say, you know, as this morning we were hearing the morning resolve, and I just love to repeat that each day, because it seems to direct our lives in the proper and keep it on the proper course. And towards the ending, you know, we see and we repeat that very familiar portion, trusting myself to divine care, providential overruling of all my interests for my highest welfare, I will seek not only to be pure in heart, but repel all anxiety, all discontent, all discouragement. I will neither murmur nor repine at what the Lord's providence may permit, because faith can firmly trust him, come what may. You know, I tremble every time I say those words. They're so all-embracing. But this is the power of the universe, the power of God exercising in and through us if we allow those words to find full expression in our daily lives and in our aspirations. Brethren, we are the essence of God's human creation. He's seeking a church. And how much, dear brethren, we are so privileged. Let us not in any way minimize or lose those privileges each day and every experience, because God has that tailor-made for you and for me, because he has special lessons that we need to learn so that we can be formulated and we can be developed into the character of Christ. I hope I haven't spent too much, infringed upon your time. God bless you and keep you.